approach is statistical, and so the observation, this is the machine, and the observation is an acoustic observation, that means the speech signal, and the task of the machine, the way it is formulated, is to find that word sequence W, which is most likely given the observed acoustics. And because of something called Bayes rule in statistics or in probability theory, the estimate of what was said is in fact to find the word sequence which maximizes this product, namely the probability that the words were spoken in the first place, and given that they were spoken, the probability that they resulted in the acoustic observation A. All right? And the language model, the task of the language model is to provide an estimate of this function, namely of the probability that the words were spoken, no matter what words you might plug in here. So it's got to be a device which is able to estimate how probable sequences of words are, and these sequences may be of any length, and usually come from some finite vocabulary that is determined ahead of time. But when I say finite, it may be like a 60,000 word vocabulary, or 100,000 word vocabulary, even like 500,000 word vocabulary. So even though I say finite, it's pretty gigantic in speech organizers that are of interest these days. All right. Now, normally the question is, how do you estimate these probabilities? And the probabilities that you estimate is, for instance, you want to know what's the probability of the next word given the past. And the question is, how would you estimate such a probability? And the simplest way would be to have some gigantic amount of text and count up how many times the string that is of interest took place, and then count up how many times the conditioning string took place, and compute this ratio. And this ratio is called the relative frequency, and it would be the relative frequency in the text from which you're extracting your parameters, the relative frequency of getting this word W0 given that past. Now the problem, of course, is that the data is sparse. In other words, we cannot conceivably think that we'll be able to get non-zero values here for all possible sequences of n words. Even if n is something like 3, and the number of words in the vocabulary is, let's say, 10,000, then that's 10,000 is 10 to the 4th, and triplets is 10 to the 4th to the 3rd, in other words, 10 to the 12th, and you'd have to have a training corpus that would be substantially bigger than 10 to the 12 words, and of course such a corpus does not exist. So the main problem of language modeling is how to overcome this sparseness of data. The fact that you may be, that during the say speech recognition you will be called upon to estimate the probability of a sequence which has never taken place in the, in your training. You've never observed this place, and yet you have to be able to supply this number. Okay? So how sparse the data is shown over here. If you take, there is something called a UPenn tree bank, and maybe I would expect that Professor Charniak talked about the UPenn tree bank, because his parser is based on this UPenn tree bank, and it's got about 82,000 words, and the question is whether, what is the percentage of trigrams in it which did not, which were not observed in the training text. and trigrams, 54% of trigrams in the eupantrigene have not been observed, and if you want 4 grams, then it's 75%, and if you want 6 grams, then it's 86%. In other words, only 14% of 6 grams would be seen. So the problem of sparseness of data is very, very serious. And actually, in all natural language processing problems, the sparseness problem is the central problem. You can imagine that if we're talking about speech recognition, then we're talking about using the acoustic patterns, and of course, nobody says the same thing the same way. Most of people say different things. I say things differently than you do. So you never observe anything twice in acoustics. Here, maybe you do observe things twice, but most of things you will not have seen, and yet you are presented with the task of estimating the probability. You might think that you will solve the problem by the fact that there exists something like the World Wide Web and that it's got a lot of data, but in fact, even though it has a gigantic amounts of data, it's not sufficient. And furthermore, in order to have an effective language model, the language model should be adjusted for the task at hand. So, for instance, if what you want to do is dictate contracts, a lawyer might want to dictate contracts, well, the data should come from contracts, the data from which we would estimate these counts that I talked about. And it should come from contracts, or if a doctor would dictate radio reading x-rays, then again, the data should come from x-rays. And there is simply not enough data, even in the World Wide Web, to overcome the sparseness. So the standard approach to overcoming the sparseness in the limited case of trigrams, in other words, trying to predict the next word given the two previous ones, is shown in this formula here. What I had before is I had the ratio of this to this. This means words starting with two back and up to the word I, and here is starting with two back and up to the word I minus one. You recall that the denominator was one word shorter than the numerator, and I am specializing it to trigrams, and between I minus 2 and I there are three words, right? So before, what we had is a ratio of this to that. In order to do the smoothing, in other words, in order to be able to come up with an estimate of trigrams we haven't seen, we have to take away some weight from the trigrams we have seen and assign them to some smoothing factor. And what you have here is that this is a trigram, and this is a probability of the next word given just the previous word. What we are wanting is the probability of next word given the previous two words, and it's obtained from some estimate of these triples plus some estimate of just pairs. And even that would be iteratively done. And there would be another formula that would have this number, and with this kind, this is known as a discount, with this discount, and then the smoothing factor would be just the probability of unigrams, which means the probability of single words without any memory. So this has memory 2, this has memory 1, and if you want it to go and estimate that, you'd use the same type of formula where this would have memory 2, memory 1, and this would have memory 1, and over here it would have memory 0. Okay? Yes?
Could you explain what is lambda here?
Lambda is some kind of a factor that you have to have so that everything sums to 1. Probabilities have to sum to 1, so if I sum this over all possible wi, it's got to add up to 1. This thing, when summed over everything, adds up to 1, and this thing, when summed over everything, will add up to some function of this D. And so the lambda will do the compensation so that the whole thing adds to 1. That is a simple formula to estimate it, but that is the function, all right? That is the reason why we have that lambda, all right? Okay, now this is very primitive what I've shown, and the question is, can we do better than the formula that I've shown here? The formula I've shown before is the standard formula, which is used in, I think I could say, in all commercial speech recognizers, and the question is, can we do better? So the idea is to use something called decision trees to do this smoothing. And an example of a decision tree is over here. And the decision tree works like this. Think of... you don't have a pointer, do you? No, you don't have one of these...
There should be.
Well, should be, yes, but...
There was one.
There was one?
Yeah.
Probably Professor Charniak took it home. It's typical. Anyway, what you have up there... But maybe we can... Well, what you have up here are like, this is the future, and these two words are the ones in the past. So this is, again, trigrams, and the two past past words are the ones which are in lighter font, and the one that we are predicting is in heavy font. All right? And let's say that the training data has consists of these examples of trigrams, all right? What we want to do is, we want to be able... Fantastic. Oh, yeah, good. So, what we want to do is, we want to decide what the probability of these words are, given some past. And if you did things only from... putting all this data together, then you would notice that there are 3 A's that take place and there are 2 B's. So if you didn't have any past and wanted to estimate what's the probability of the next word being A or what's the probability of the next word being B, then A would be 3, the ratio of A's to B's would be 3 to 2. Now, in a decision tree, you would start asking questions. You would like to make a sort of an equivalence classification of this past that is going to tell us what the future should be. And the question might be, for instance, is the first word an A or is the first word a B? Here, the first word is A, and here the first word is B. So if you did it, then for every... If you settled on these questions, then if the first word was A, then you would be sure, at least from this training data, that the word you're predicting is an A, because when the first word was A, the word of interest was A and never B. So you would then say that the probability of A is 1, actually, because B never took place. And if the first word was B, then this by coincidence or by design, this B sort of determines what this B, that the future has to be B. So the idea of a decision tree is to ask these questions in a judicious way and then keep going and keep asking other questions to split the data. This splits the data. This question, is it A or is it B, splits the data into 2 parts, and presumably you would do this judiciously and have some kind of an equivalence classification of the past. The equivalence classification here is primitive and very bad on purpose, all right? Here it says that all sequences in the past which start with an A are one equivalence class, and all sequences of the past which start with a B are a second equivalence class. And what the decision tree should do, and we should have techniques which do it, is to choose by asking questions about the past, choose equivalence classes that would be efficient and good in predicting what comes next. All right. So here is an example of what we would want to do. It's done badly. All right. But of course, this is a primitive example in that there are that there is too little data to construct this decision tree with any confidence. But that would be the idea of a decision tree language model. All right. In other words, this thing would keep on splitting, and we would ask some complicated questions about what the past is. And of course, I have here only a vocabulary of three words, four words, either A, B, C, or D, and the future seems, by coincidence, to be either A or B. So, you know, our interest is in vocabularies of tens of thousands of words. So decision trees are used for most of the time for diagnosis, and here I think is a diagnosis of some kind of a sickness. And you might ask, is there high fever? If there is, you ask, is there chest pain? If there is chest pain, your estimate is that the sickness is of type L1. If there isn't, then the sickness is of L2, etc. So here you see a classification which doesn't predict the next word, which is the usual way of presenting of use of decision trees, namely in diagnosis. All right, and again, of course, this is a cooked up example. And the question, of course, here, if you want to know if these equivalence classes of sicknesses in these diagnoses are to make sense, then of course it's important that you ask the right questions. All right, maybe cough is not the right question. Maybe what's the right question is whether your left toe hurts you or something. All right, and so the task of putting all this together is not just the task of having some data where, from which you estimate or from which you come up with decisions, but also what should be the class of questions that we might ask. So normally, the normal formal way of doing it is that we have data pairs, namely we have the data about which we will ask questions and the diagnosis. And we would have in the training data this kind of entities, namely sets of data and diagnosis, and then from this we would want to find out what the decision tree ought to come up with. All right? I mean, what ought to be the classifier? Okay, and we've discussed this, that the sparseness problem forces us to partition the data into equivalence classes. We will not be able to say necessarily that somebody, you know, it will not be that if that even though, for instance, this might be cancer and this might be a heart attack and this might be, I don't know, some other sickness and this might be just a common cold, you will not be able to find an equivalence class which would be pure. In other words, eventually in the data you will not in fact have at the leaves of the, these are the leaves, this is a leaf. You will not probably have pure classes. In other words, the decision, the diagnosis will not be unequivocal, but hopefully some particular sickness, if it's for sicknesses, will dominate in these leaves. Okay. So I've already said that decision trees are a method of equivalence classification of data, and
and successive questions in the tree are asked about the data, and the answers lead to the leaf. We've said it, and it's the leaf which will give you the diagnosis. And each leaf, of course, again coming back to what we had before, each leaf is specified by the answers to questions. So this leaf is specified by the answer yes to the first question and no to the other. This leaf is specified by yes to these two questions. This leaf is specified by no to this question, yes to this question, and yes to that question. All right. So now, when and this is obtained from the training data, and now a new patient comes in, all right, and you ask him those questions, and if in fact he didn't have high fever but had a headache and was not coughing, then you say that most probably his sickness is this, all right? Okay, we've gone through that. Okay, so now we're going to go and construct the decision tree from scratch. This was an example, and this is the general approach to construct decision trees. So each possible question, each answer to a question, and we'll assume that the questions are only yes or no. Alright, so does somebody have cough or not? Each question partitions the data into two sets depending whether the data answers yes or no to the question. So you start out by having a set of questions which you could ask. And in that particular example, the first question was, was there high fever? Well, there were all other questions that needed to be asked. And the question that could have been asked, like about cough or whatever, and you have to decide which one should be the first question you ask. All right. So you ask all the questions that are allowed. You have a list of them, and you find out which question has the highest value in partitioning the data into two parts. All right. Yes and no will always partition the data into two parts, and you have to have some kind of an evaluation function which will tell you whether this partition is a good partition or this partition is a bad partition. So in order to construct a decision tree, you need to have a set of questions that you may ask, and secondly, you need to have an evaluation function to see what the worth of the question is. And finally, you need to have a stopping criteria. Why do we need to have a stopping criteria? Well, obviously, if I will keep on asking questions, then eventually there will be only one event from the training data that will remain in the leaf. And that will not be statistically significant. That will not be statistically reliable. You will be in a situation where you decided that something has value on the basis of too little evidence. So we not only have to have an evaluation function, but we need to have a stopping criterion which will say, well, beyond this, to ask question and evaluate makes no sense because your evaluation will not be based on enough evidence. All right? So these are the three things that you have to have to construct the language, to construct a decision tree. So here is an example again, all right? And here is the problem that you might run into. This is the same example that I had, but the problem is that suppose our decision tree from the training data constructed itself like this, and then we now apply the decision tree to data which we want to use. In other words, a patient comes in, and he has and he is in this situation, all right? And everything is fine here because if his data is BDB and he asks the question, first of all, is the first word B, then in fact the answer for this person, I'm running out of,
The answer for this person will be yes. The first word is B, and then we will predict that his trouble is of the kind B, and indeed that is the case. All right. So if things like that take place, then everything was fine, and you constructed a decision tree which made sense for this example. But what if, in fact, somebody came up and his situation was this one, and you asked this question, and the answer for this position was A, and it now said, the decision tree said, he is of the situation three, A, but in fact, he was of the situation B. So, and the reason, of course, that we ran into this problem is that we constructed this decision tree on too little data. We were too sparse. An even worse thing is that can happen is that during the test, somebody with this situation came in, and the questions that are asked do not apply to him. Because the first position was not an A, and the first position was not a B, it in fact was C, and we seem to be stuck. So we have to figure out a way in constructing the decision tree so that this situation happens as rarely as possible, and this situation happens never. By never, I mean that we know how to treat this situation as well. All right. Here we simply make an error, but here we don't even know how to treat it, if that's the whole decision thing. So now we're going to go to the example of language models, where in fact we're going to be trying to predict the third word, and we're going to predict the third word from the previous two. And what we're going to do is, the way we're going to predict it, don't forget that these W's are in a vocabulary of something like 10,000 different possibilities. And the question is, is it an A or is it a B? It's got to be, the question has to be, is W minus 1 in some set which is a substantial part of the vocabulary, and is W minus 1 in the complement of this vocabulary. So, you know, imagine that the vocabulary is 10,000, and the question you want to ask is the previous word among these 3,000 words, or is it not among these 3,000 words? And then your problem is to decide which 3,000 words are significant and should be in that part about which you ask. Is that clear? You know, in the language modeling, because it's a gigantic problem, it's not a problem like the diagnosis where there is either cough or high fever or something, where the number of possibilities is small. Here, the number of possibilities is gigantic, because we can ask a question about any subset of the vocabulary, and we have to determine which subset are we going to ask a question about. All right. And by the way, when we construct these decision trees, just imagine that this is now a decent decision tree. Whenever I ask a question like this one, I don't mean question about A, but for instance, is the first word in some set of words? All right. Then, if the answer is yes, the amount of data that I have at my disposal when I will ask the next question is now smaller, because the data to which this answer is, the answer to this question is no, all the data is sucked away to this part of the tree and does not stay in this part of the tree. So this decision, this evaluation is reliable, because maybe it's based on a lot of data, but the question that I'm going to ask next is less reliable, because it's going to be asked about less data. And that's one of the problems of constructing decision trees.
All right. So, question number one is, how do we decide? How do we decide on these sets?
To remind you, how do we decide? I never see it. Okay. How do we decide on these sets?
And the way we decide is on the basis of something that's called an exchange algorithm. And it works like this. First of all, keep in mind that we have an evaluation function. I haven't told you yet what that evaluation function is, but there is an evaluation function which says that if I have split the training data into these two parts, then it's worth so much and so much. My problem is that this set is gigantic. It has 10,000 of these black points, and I've got to split it into two parts. So the way I go about it is I split it arbitrarily into parts, perhaps at random. And then I start seeing whether the evaluation function, you see, whether the evaluation is better if I move, for instance, this entity into this side, or if I move this entity into that side. And I keep trying. So I start out by having this at random, and then I will start improving it, all right? And for instance, it might turn out that by moving this entity, in this case this word, to this set, the evaluation function improves. Well, I keep doing it by taking all the possible switches, and once a switch makes it better, I leave it as it is and try to do another switch maybe. Well, now that I moved it over, right, now the decision boundary became like this because the thing that was on the left is now on the right. And I keep going on and on until this steadies itself, all right? And I get, by this greedy algorithm, I get the best result. Now, what do I mean by greedy? By greedy is that I don't, that when I move these points from one side to the other, I just evaluate it and I don't think of the consequences that will be later encountered by moving it. It's only that move that made it better, but maybe in the long run that move is not very good. Are you following me? In other words, it's greedy because once I make the decision, I make it on the basis of the set as it is. It's just that when I move that that word, it is better. But maybe overall, if I then move three more from the right to the left, I would regret that I moved this one to the right. All right. So, and this is important to the rest of the discussion, namely that this is a greedy way of doing things and that it also depends on my original arbitrary split between the two sides. In other words, the fact that I made the set membership to start with like this is something that I will, whose consequences will always be with me, all right? So what I do is I do something at random and then I try to ameliorate it, but I ameliorate it only locally. I only ameliorate it in a greedy manner. Okay. So this is the formula that I had before. That's the Knezenide way of doing things, and the question is, what will be the probability estimates that will be associated with the decision tree? Well, just going back again, the decision tree is going to have at the leaves some sets, and this situation. I guess it's losing its illumination. But this situation can still take place, and I've got to this type of situation, in other words, that I run into a situation which I have not seen in the in the development of the decision tree training data, may still take place, and I therefore have to take care of that probability as well. And this is the function. This is the function of this. Of this smoothing. In other words, normally the probability of the leaf would be just the probability of obtained from the relative frequency of this equivalence class on the leaf predicting the next word divided by the number of counts of the equivalence class itself, in other words, of the entities that are in the leaf. But because there are things that can happen that have not happened in the in the construction, I've got to subtract this discount, and I've got to smooth it by something that depends on less data, on a shorter memory. And in fact, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to do the simple thing, namely that I will construct the back-off. This is called a back-off. This is the this is the probability we are aiming at, but because in fact it may not be perfect, I've got to allow myself a way out, and that's called the back-off. And this is done on the basis of trigrams, and this will be done on the basis of bigrams, in other words, of a single memory. And so over here, for the back-off, I will use this old formula. So just to show again what the decision tree is going to look like, I may, as I go down the decision tree, again, don't see it. Oh, here we are. As I go down the decision tree, I may run into a situation where the question I'm asking has no answer. Just like if I asked A or B, it would have no answer here. And in that case, I've got to treat it in some way. And the way I treat it is the old way, meaning in this Knezenhai formula. All right? So I always have a way out. The way out is the standard one, but I'm trying to do something better by constructing these decision trees. All right. Here is the evaluation function. All right. The evaluation function is known as perplexity, and the point simply is that we will take our test data, or in fact some data that I held aside, and I will try to find out what's the probability of that data given the decision tree itself. Notice this is a sum of logarithms, which is the same as the product of things. The logarithm of a product is the sum of logarithms, all right? So to evaluate things by a sum of logarithms is the same thing like evaluating it by a product. And so essentially, this evaluation is the evaluation of how much probability I assign to some text which I have held on the side, all right? And so when I do the exchange algorithm for the language model, the way I evaluate it is whether it will improve the probability of some text which was not part of the training data but which was set aside to judge the training data. All right, it's called a held out set. All right. So this is the situation, and if you try to do construct a language model by constructing these decision trees, it turns out that you will lose. That even though people have tried for decades to see if they can improve over this Knezenhai formula, which was the first formula I had, by a decision tree language model of the type I described, in fact, it turns out that on test data it does worse. Now, why does it do worse? It does worse because of the sparseness. It does worse because you have two choices. As you develop the tree, you eventually are developing on less and less data. If you stop early, then the decision is based on enough data, but the equivalence classes are not refined sufficiently. And if you stop too late, then the decision, the equivalence classes are sufficiently refined, but they are based on too little data. And this is a dilemma that people have been trying to fight for many years. All right. So the question is, yet the decision tree approach seems to be, you know, sort of natural to try, because to do things by trigrams, to do things by predicting the next word from the previous two words, and if not available, then just from the previous word, that seems much too mechanical, while doing something like the decision trees seems much more natural, if only you knew how to construct the decision tree. And again, the problem is with the stepping criterion and with making decisions on too little evidence. All right. So what came along is, well, I've just now said what the problems are. There is a famous statistician named Bryman who actually died 2 years ago. And he decided that the way to ameliorate this problem is through something that is called a random forest. Namely, what you do is you construct sets of decision trees, and you make and you terminate them relatively early. But because you have sets of decision trees and they are all constructed differently, they look at the data from a different point of view. And the idea is that if you look at the data from a different point of view, in this particular case that I will discuss will be 100 different points of view, we will try to overcome this dilemma of stopping early and not being detailed, or stopping late and being based on too little evidence. All right? And he again applied it to a diagnosis, in other words, of the case of diagnosing a sickness. So in his case, the number of questions that had to be asked was relatively small, you know, like cough, height, fever, leg hurting, I don't know what else I have there, a prescribed number of questions. And then his formula or his approach was simply to make the majority decision. Here is an example. Suppose in his case he constructed three trees, all right, and these three trees he constructed to them he brought a question for diagnosis. And since the three trees are different, even though they are made up of different questions, of the same questions, but they are different because the questions are asked at a different time, then maybe in the tree number one, the equivalence class that we ended up with is the alpha equivalence class, in tree number two is the alpha equivalence class, and tree number three is the beta equivalence class. If that's the case, then his decision is simple. You count up how many times you got the alpha equivalence class, how many times you got the beta equivalence class. Since you got more times the equivalence class alpha than beta, you will decide that the sickness is alpha. Is that clear? So the point is that there will be voting. We will construct a lot of decision trees and we will vote among them. All right? Now, of course, problem of language modeling, there is no voting. What we need is a probability distribution. So, the probability distribution will be like I have over here. In other words, I will have 100 decision trees. All right,
and each decision tree will come up with an estimate of the probability of the next word given the previous two words, and I will simply average it, and that will be the probability that I'm going to be using. All right? So the question then is, how am I going to construct these decision trees, these 100 decision trees? And the answer is that I will construct them by making random decisions during the construction. So what are the random decisions? If you recall, the questions were whether the previous word belonged to some set or to another set, all right? Or whether the word before that belonged to one set or another set. So the questions that I can ask at any given moment are questions: should I ask about this position, should I ask about this position, or should I ask about either of these positions and choose the one that gives me a better evaluation criteria? All right? So there are three cases. Case to ask about this position, case to ask about this position, or the case of asking about the better of the two positions. You understand what I mean by better? In other words, you ask about one position, you ask about two positions, you apply your evaluation criterion, and whichever comes out better, that's the position you ask. All right? So one randomness is that at random you choose among these three possibilities. All right? Position one, position two, or the better of the two. So that's one randomness. Secondly, the random initialization of the exchange algorithm. You recall that when I have the exchange algorithm, I at random divided the sets into two subsets, and then I try to ameliorate it. Well, the first decision, the first distribution of the vocabulary words into two paths can be done at random, and that's another source of randomness. And the third is random training data selection. Namely, you recall that the training data were these pairs of X and Y. In this particular case, X are the two previous words, and Y is the word we are predicting, all right? And we had this whole set of data from which we were going to construct the decision tree. Here what's suggested is that we will choose from that set a subset from which we are going to do the construction. In other words, we will always throw a coin. Should the first pair XY be included or should it not be included? And we keep going round and round until we get enough. I don't know if you understand it, if I've made myself clear here. In other words, every pair XY gets a chance to be included in the data, but you also have a criterion how much data you want. So you keep going round and round with this random process until you have accumulated enough data. So that means from the data that you started out with, certain things will be chosen more than once, and other things will not be chosen at all. Everything is random. All right? So, yes?
Excuse me, and why do you have only two positions?
Oh, because I want to be fair here, and I want to see, because the standard results are trigram results, and I want to be fair and compare the result of the random forest with the result of the Knez and I decision procedure. All right. Actually, later on, I will show the results for 5 grams. All right. But that's the reason that I only have two. All right. Okay. So then we try to do some experiments, and these are our experiments. The results that we're quoting are what's known as perplexities. That's the formula that I had there, that I had up there before. Where is that formula? Here, this formula. This formula, the smaller this number, the better the prediction is, because this number, this number will be small provided this probability is large. All right. So we are evaluating on some separate set of data how big this perplexity is, and a smaller perplexity is better. And here are the results of the evaluation. If you do things on the on held-out data on the basis of which you evaluate, on the basis of which you you decide to terminate, or you decide to stop the stopping criterion, then in fact the decision tree trigram, the single decision tree trigram, is a little bit better than the perplexity of the Knez-Nye approach, but the random forest trigram is much better. If you apply to the test situation, we've already observed that in fact the decision tree is worse, but the random forest is better. Here is a graph of what happens as we increase the number of decision trees in the random set. We start out with one decision tree and go all the way to 100. And as you see, the situation improves. This 145 is the result of the random forest. To start with, using one decision tree, you see we get some a perplexity that is worse, but already with 10 decision trees we get something better, and eventually we settle at 100 by something that is substantially better than the standard procedure. Here is a question of test data, of test results, depending on how many times we have seen the test problem in the 100 decision trees. In other words, you remember that we, in the example decision tree, we had these situations which perhaps was not seen anywhere. All right. Now things are much better, because even though something might be very rare, it may at least occur, for instance, in 1 to 9 different decision trees out of the 100. In other words, I didn't have to go to the smoothing, to the back off. I could have just continued. I could have gotten my result from the regular decision tree. I'll say it again. The formula had two parts, if you remember. The first part was from the decision tree, and the second part was the back off. And of course, I don't want to go to the back off. That's only something that I want to use in emergency, because the back off cannot do better than what the Knez-Nye approach does. All right. So here it shows you how much better the random forest is than the Knez-Nye situation. If, for instance, the problem, if the datum, the test datum you have presented to the random forest has been seen in between 90 and 99 of the trees. In other words, if between 90 and 99 of the trees ended up without having to recourse to that backoff. And as you see, if you've seen it in many more trees, then the advantage over the Knez-Nye is substantial. But if you haven't seen it in any of the trees, then the Knez-Nye is better. And also, if you've seen it in less than 10 trees, in fact, it is better. Here is here is the stability of the situation. This is what happens when you construct the random forest out of 10 decision trees. These decision trees individually have perplexities that are shown over here. This is the perplexity of the first decision tree, this is the perplexity of the second, third, fourth, fifth, etc. But when they are put together as a random forest, then the probability, then the perplexity of the random forest made up of six possible decision tree, for instance, is only this. Is not only this. All is good. I mean, it keeps going down. We go down really to 100. It's interesting that this random procedure more or less allows every decision tree to be about this good, the way I'm showing it, but cumulatively it keeps improving. You asked me about what happens if we go to more than memory, more than three, and this is what happens if you go to memory more than three. In the Knezenai, of course, improves also, but the random forest improves. Notice that there is some problem over here. This still improves slightly, and we have not been able to, I mean, we haven't worked very hard on it, but we haven't been able to improve things between taking 5 grams or taking 6 grams. In other words, asking questions about 5 grams and asking questions about 6 grams. Here are some results that have to do with actual speech recognition, namely applying the random forest language model to a famous test in speech recognition circles. The baseline, the result is where is it? You see? Ah, here. Baseline result is 13.7% of error, and we're getting somewhat better. All right. The error rate has decreased by 1%. The question is, what is the, how good is the performance of the random forest relative to the amount of data on which it is based? And as you see, the advantage over the Knezenai gets worse if it's based on more data. And that shows that the random forest is here. Its power is in smoothing, and when the amount of data, 20 million words of data on which the language model is based, when the amount gets doubled, then the Knezenai improves more than the random forest. In other words, the compensation of the random forest is for sparseness, and the sparseness is less, and therefore the compensation is not as good. This happens to be another language model, which is called the structured language model, about which we're not going to talk, and there the advantage is whatever it shows you. We have also done this performance on some much bigger data sets based on many more amounts of data, also much bigger data, much bigger vocabularies, much bigger training data of the acoustic processor in the speech organizer, and there the results are as you see. Again, when the amount of data is less, then the advantage of the random forest is more. The practical limitations, of course, of this approach are what I'm showing here. It is slower, of course, because I have to have 100 trees, and I have to store them, and so it's a much more cumbersome process. And we are trying to work on seeing whether we can compress the language model so that the its performance is faster. By the way, it is so slow that we cannot use it as a basic language model. What we do is we use the Knezenai language model to give us something like 1,000 possible transcriptions, and then we reevaluate the transcriptions as they were presented by the regular language, by the regular speech organizer, by reevaluating it through the random forest language model. I think these are the general results or general considerations from this research, and here are some other conclusions, and that's the end of my talk. So. To me, it is remarkable and interesting that doing things at random and not trying to do things the best way, but being satisfied with something approximately best is better than going after the best thing. Yes.
Have you tried either using
yes.
You tried running mixing parameters?
Yes, very good. I took it out because I somehow overestimated how long this is going to take. We actually did try, and I will go back to here. Oops. I need to find the formula. Here. Here I am taking into account each decision tree the same way. They get the same weight. And you would think that if I relaxed it and allowed each decision tree a different weight, that there would be better decision trees and worse decision trees. The better decision trees would get more weight, the worse ones would get less weight, and that I would improve. The answer is that I hardly improve at all. And when you evaluate it and get the best coefficients, here the coefficient is 1/100. Imagine that the coefficient was alpha, all right? Alpha sub I for the i's decision trees. The difference in size between the largest alpha and the smallest alpha is only 4:1. You would think that by this random procedure among 100 decision trees, a good decision tree would be 100 or even 1,000 times better than a bad one. And it's not the case.
So, I was just thinking, is the intuition here that the advantage that you get from random forest is because, well, the normal decision tree construction algorithm is greedy, so you have to pick a choice worse impact if you pick a variety of
Well, the intuition is that you can afford to stop earlier, and therefore, in the individual trees, you can afford to stop earlier, and therefore keep making decisions on the basis of enough data, even though at random. Because you will get another chance to look at the problem from another point of view in another tree. The problem with a single decision tree is that if you stop too early, then you don't have a sufficiently detailed equivalence class. But here, the equivalence class is the composite equivalence class of the 100 trees. And that is quite refined. Any other questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much.